From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. California's new pot rules went into effect at the start of this year. Though many are celebrating legal cannabis, others see a much more complicated picture, one that involves new players, more regulation, and shifting power dynamics. And so we're dedicating this week's show to these issues. What does the new era of legalized pot in California mean for food, farming, and business?
Edibles kind of have a tough rap because of their potential attractiveness to kids, and that's always in the forefront of regulators' minds.
That's Hillary Bricken of the Harris Bricken Law Firm. She's one of the premier cannabis business attorneys in the country. She's talking to me about California's new pot rules as they pertain to the food and beverage industry. Bricken says that legal weed doesn't necessarily mean a bright future for edibles. In fact, it might be just the opposite.
With regulation is going to come a cut down in innovation. It's happened in every single state. California will not be the first, and it won't be the last.
So who is the head of the LA regulatory agency? I'm supposing there is one, correct?
There is, yeah. Within the city of Los Angeles, we have the Department of Cannabis Regulation. We also have the Cannabis Regulation Commission. Together, they will assess the fitness of applicants to run cannabis businesses here in Los Angeles, including manufacturers of food.
And I just have to ask this, which is a more general kind of question, but how difficult is it for the state that every municipality has the right to tailor regulations to their own sets of, quote, needs and values?
I think it's been a pretty tough road to hoe. With 482 cities, 58 counties, everybody doing their own little regulations within their fiefdom, I think it's made it really tough for the state to provide clarity to licensees regarding what they can and cannot do in their given jurisdictions. And no one jurisdiction is the same. We've seen staggered licenses from day one, or even today, we still have no licensees in the city of Los Angeles.
So let's get into what is allowed and what isn't allowed with the world of edibles. I just think it's fascinating how they've drawn the lines. It's almost like gerrymandering.
Yes, it is. And certain edibles have made the list and certain edibles have not. And I think California, in its edibles policy, which we're going to continue to see to evolve over time, has borrowed heavily from what other states have done. And if people remember back in 2012, when Washington and Colorado legalized, shortly thereafter, Colorado had a huge love affair with kind of fingering edibles and what they found to be mysterious and dangerous. And eventually, this all culminated in kind of a master prohibited products list and kind of kosher edibles list, not literally kosher, but politically kosher, that all states have borrowed from. And California is also in that boat.
So let's go down the list. What's easier? What's allowed or what's not allowed?
Definitely what's not allowed, as the list is longer and more comprehensive. So to all you budding chefs out there that thought you would do, you know, fresh food packaging in the cannabis industry in California, no longer an option. And from the top down, basically what's prohibited, nicotine-based products, anything that you're going to infuse with caffeine or alcohol, probably off the table, any refrigerated food or fresh food that needs to be refrigerated for consumption, frozen food is gone, so no ice cream, unfortunately, any food that needs to be heated that's fit for consumption, seafood, meat products outside of dried meat, juice is allowed, dairy products are a no-go, with the exception of butter. And I could go on, but I'll spare you the details.
So what's really interesting, as a person who followed the cottage law as it was being rolled out, the law that allowed home cooks to be able to manufacture in their home kitchens for sale, a lot of these prohibitions basically mirror the cottage law.
I would say that that's probably correct, whereas we're not going to see kind of any home-based businesses or anything that's really truly organic in nature. Literally, we cannot label products organic because we don't have approval from the USDA because it's federally illegal. So you are going to see most of this manufacturing take place in really anesthetized kind of lab commercial kitchen settings.
And the fact that thus far it appears that the consumption of either edibles or smokables will not be allowed in any kind of public place, then that also cuts out the ability for a licensed operation of, let's say, a cafe.
That is correct. That is absolutely 100% correct. You cannot consume in public. You cannot consume anywhere where tobacco smoking is prohibited. You are correct. Now, we have some options for on-site consumption. Again, it has to be approved by the local jurisdiction. The only city in LA County that has done that so far is West Hollywood. So we could see some iteration of cannabis bars or lounges. But even in order to have on-site consumption, you have to be a retail or a micro business licensee. So you can't just start doing this as an individual. You have to go through the licensing process as well.
So it's almost like you have to be vertically integrated, because if you're a licensee, aren't you also a grower?
You don't have to be vertically integrated. It is purely optional. There are some states that prohibit vertical integration. California is not one of them. So you could just pop off and have your own retail operation, on-site consumption in Hollywood. But the kind of questions that I get are, can I have a mobile kitchen? Can I do a food truck? Can I cater private and public dinners? And those conversations are becoming increasingly complicated as these regulations roll out, because frankly, I don't think the state of California wants to make this a super sexy experience because of public policy and health reasons.
Which is just odd, because it's been such a part of sort of the California myth for so long.
I agree. And it's very normalized already. This is not a state that just got this overnight. So to take away this innovation, the creativity, the communal sense of being able to share cannabis openly in some ways undermines this democratic experiment, because it's going to cut down on that normalization that we're otherwise used to.
So tourism, we can't expect a boom.
In certain places, you may. In West Hollywood, I would anticipate people from anywhere in the world, 21 and up, will treat it almost like an Amsterdam experience if there's on-site consumption. And just the novelty of being able to come to the United States, come to California, purchase up to an ounce or less and walk out, pretty sexy still for most of those people. We will also have bastions of prohibition that will not sign on to this. For example, LA County still has a ban, so we're not going to have any access there. Same thing with Orange County. So we could see enclaves of tourism. It's going to be a very slow rollout, though.
So the ban, you're talking about on-site consumption.
I am talking about all commercial cannabis activity, not just on-site consumption, but the majority of California cities have not endorsed on-site consumption at all.
Okay, so when do you think we're going to start seeing the rollout of the first licenses for purchasing in Los Angeles County?
So for LA County, which is different than the city of LA, probably over the next year or so. I don't anticipate that it's going to be an overnight kind of rollout once they do come online. With the city of Los Angeles, they have started accepting temporary approval applications from existing dispensaries. None of them have been approved for state licensure just yet. But I anticipate that they'll probably come online in the next couple of months.
So let's talk about where you can consume what it is you purchased. If you are a renter, can you consume it at home?
What does your lease say is my question to your question, because we still have the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, which indirectly prohibits illegal activity on the property, and it doesn't make a differentiation between state law and federal law. You could also have a quiet enjoyment clause, which means we'll leave you alone as long as you're in compliance with the lease, you're not disturbing other neighbors. So if you have a neighbor that's very sensitive to cannabis smoke, or let's just say they're puritanical and they don't like it, they could have an issue with the building, take it to the landlord, and you can have problems. So it just depends on your lease.
And yet people could kick back and drink a 24-pack of beer.
Absolutely.
All righty then. And hotel rooms?
Same thing. Just depends on the habitable policy of the hotel, what they will and will not allow. A lot of them do not want illegal activity federally taking place on the property, because it opens the door potentially to other substances, other behaviors that they really want to prohibit. So it just depends on the hotel. And certainly, there will be beds and breakfasts and hotels that will take advantage of this, almost like in wine country, right? There is a story out there. Nipton, California, small town in the desert, was purchased by a cannabis company that wanted to turn it into the Disneyland of cannabis in Southern California. We'll see if it happens. But those kinds of tourist ideas, they are possible. I think it's just going to take some time to roll them out with the approval of the city. I don't think the state is necessarily part of that conversation.
So interesting. So over the past several years, there have been these chef-driven cannabis dinners that people have bought tickets to, gone to, enjoyed, or not, depending upon their level of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Is this just totally banned? Can this happen in West Hollywood?
Probably not allowed. And there are a couple caveats here about when we can have kind of open on-site consumption. You have your on-site consumption lounges. You also have a caveat in the law that will give someone a temporary event license, but it's under two very specific circumstances: district agricultural associations and county fairs. I don't think celebrity dinners are going to be thrown at a county fair with petting goats in the petting zoo. I could be wrong, but those are really the three that are ultimately most sanctioned by the state. Now, what's to prohibit somebody from doing, you know, bring your own green, BYOG at someone's home? Nothing. But the chef cannot receive any remuneration for the product that he produces or she produces at the dinner. We can gift each other cannabis in certain circumstances, but that's it. So the chef loses the financial incentive to participate in that way.
Okay, so coming across my Facebook page, I've seen photographs of wine infused with cannabis.
Not going to be a reality going forward. Definitely infusions of alcohol with cannabis are a big no-no with the Bureau of Cannabis Control and the California Department of Public Health. That is on the prohibited products list. I should also mention, anything that looks like commercially available candy, or that's a rip on that, also not allowed. And then any type of product that is literally in the shape of a human, animal, or fruit, not allowed. So bye-bye, gummy bears.
So as we sit here having this conversation, we're doing so after Attorney General Jeff Sessions came out and made a statement intimating that he was all for going out and enforcing federal marijuana law. What has that done to the rollout here in California?
Nothing really. Regulators, the state attorney general, Gavin Newsom, they've all said, we're moving forward. We've been charged by a vote of the people to implement this thing, and we're going to do it. We're going to do our jobs, and essentially DOJ be damned. Now, that is a precarious position to be in, depending on your district. And here in LA, we're in the Central District, and we just had a new U.S. attorney appointed under Sessions and Trump, who has an illustrious record of prosecuting drug trafficking crimes and drug traffickers. So we'll see how that plays out in practicality, probably in the courtroom.
That's Hillary Bricken, partner at the Harris Bricken Law Firm. We've been talking about California's new pot rules and their impact on the manufacture of edibles. She has an explainer on our Good Food blog. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, we're asking whether we're at the dawn of a corporate age of pot. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Coming back to Good Food on KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this week we're talking all about cannabis.
You can patent something that is illegal to buy and sell and use, but you still are able to prevent other people from, you know, infringing on your intellectual property somehow. That doesn't necessarily give you the right to sell it, but you can stop other people from selling it, which just doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Cannabis is a $40 billion industry, making it the second biggest crop after corn. And with that much money at stake, it's inevitable that people are making moves to corner the market. But who are they? Journalist Amanda Chicago Lewis has some answers. You know, we should be really happy about this, but all these things are happening that are starting to make me sad.
What's making you sad, Evan?
Well, I don't think we need another corporate age of anything, but...
It's true.
So I understand that a major player is working on getting utility patents on various strains of cannabis. Perhaps you could start by explaining what a utility patent is.
Sure. A utility patent is the most comprehensive and strictest kind of patent that you can get, especially when it comes to plants. Utility patents were only available on plants starting in about 1980, and that originally was for genetically modified organisms. And essentially, they are so strict that you aren't able to keep the seeds that come from the plants that you grow and replant the next year. You have to buy patented seeds again instead of using what you are naturally producing. And you can essentially be growing in your backyard, and a big organization like Monsanto might show up with paperwork suing you for growing their intellectual property.
Now, I know that for a lot of seeds that have these kind of utility patents, they're hybrid seeds, which means that they don't grow true. They're not heirloom seeds. In the case of marijuana, are some of the strains that are being patented heirloom seeds, open pollinated seeds that could grow true?
That is a great question. It is unclear. I mean, essentially, marijuana is still in an almost pre-industrial space right now. And so there is some debate about whether or not there have been any stabilized lines created. The people who have been obtaining these utility patents say that they have stabilized lines. The people who think that their patents are illegitimate and are trying to challenge them think that if we went into the seed bank in Scotland that's holding the seeds that these people have patented and we grew some generations out, we would find that they were, in fact, not stabilized.
And being unstabilized means that they will revert.
Right. Well, yes, that they won't be the same type of cannabis generation after generation.
Do we know who this major player is?
We have some idea, yes. And this story that I did for GQ in the September issue sort of uncovered someone that we may think is probably maybe the primary investor behind it, but we're not really sure. It's sort of unclear. We definitely know the patents are held by an entity called Biotech Institute, and this is an LLC that seems to have been created simply for the purpose of holding the patents. There are only a couple of names associated with these patents and with this LLC. The lead inventor on the patents tells me that he's no longer working with this company, even though he did a lot of breeding work for them in documenting the stuff on the patents. I'm not 100% sure that I believe him. And then there is this attorney in Century City. His name is on several different cannabis and cannabis-related companies, this being one of them. And it's hard to say whether these are actually separate entities or whether it's a group of people that's sort of working together toward a single goal with this guy at the head of it. His name is Gary Hiller. And so the question of where the money is coming from and what they plan to do with the patents was sort of what prompted the investigation that I did.
For a practical matter, will there be protection for people who have been growing artisanally, I guess we're calling it now, like let's say in the Emerald Triangle, for years and years and years, and who have created their own proprietary strain? Or would they need to go get a patent of their own to protect themselves?
So it's completely unclear what's going to happen, when these people are going to try to enforce the patents that they've obtained, and how that will go. One of the other things about utility patents is they cover broad swaths of variation. And so it's not just a patent on a single strain, it's a patent on all of the strains that fit a certain chemical profile. So it's fairly comprehensive. In terms of the proprietary strains grown by people in the Emerald Triangle, you know, one of the things about proving that you can't get a patent on something is you have to have sort of documented commercial activity. And since all of this has been happening on the black market, or here in California, what we call a gray market, sort of semi-regulated but not really, there's not really a lot of documentation showing, hey, I've been illegally growing this special strain in the backwoods for 30 years. What we do have is something called the Open Cannabis Project, which is based out of Oregon and is collecting strain data from all over the place and is trying to put that data in the public domain in order to potentially mount a challenge to these existing patents and any other patents that might come up. And they are becoming increasingly prominent. They have the participation now of a man named John Gilmore, who was involved in some early Electronic Frontier Foundation stuff with, you know, making the internet more open. And they are hoping to, you know, raise the kind of money that would stop these patents from ever being enforced on people like the people you're describing.
Wow, so fascinating. So obviously this dash for patents is a product of legalization.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been studying any other parts of legalization that you find to be equally odd?
I have. I mean, every aspect of legalization is very odd. Cannabis is the primary thing that I write about and have been covering for the past 5 years or so. I think probably the most important thing is the fact that cannabis remains federally illegal causes so many problems. And whether it's preventing patients from understanding the true medical nature or potential of the products that they're buying and understanding dosage and understanding safety and guaranteeing that the thing that says the bottle is going to be in the bottle is actually in the bottle. We're back in sort of a 19th century, you know, guy coming into town on his horse and being like, hey, I've got this heroin for your cough. And you're like, sure, that sounds right. And, you know, there's no FDA protections. Two, the EPA doesn't want to put in the money to study pesticide use on cannabis. And cannabis is a rather unique crop, which means that the states are being forced to make these decisions on their own without any research about what chemicals affect people when they are smoked. There's a lot of sort of dangerous stuff out there that's being used and a lot of like lack of clarity around that. And then probably one of the most important things is that because banks are regulated and insured by the federal government, banks will not do business with cannabis businesses, which means it's very difficult to track ownership. It's very difficult to understand who's even running some of these companies. That was some of the difficulty I ran into with this company that's got the patents. It means cash is changing hands, large amounts of cash in somewhat dangerous ways. It means that we are inviting in sort of, you know, risk-taking investors and folks who are not necessarily trustworthy, because in order to participate in the industry, you need to take this sort of leap where you break federal law and you don't work with the banking system and you have to sort of...
Sounds kind of familiar when it comes to drugs.
yeah, exactly. So it's sort of this weird mix of legality and illegality. And it's actually perpetuating the kind of conditions that are the kinds of things that Attorney General Jeff Sessions complains about. He complains about the fact that legalization has been cover for a lot of black market trafficking. And the truth is that it has, but that's only because there are prohibition states next to legal states, and the economic demand for cannabis is always going to be there, and interstate commerce is something that's very difficult to stop. And so, you know, it's a fascinating and strange industry. It has, like, enormous potential effects on medical practices for every American. You know, there's a lot of evidence showing cannabis can help with chronic pain and some of the things that people are using opioids for and that people are getting addicted to opioids for. You know, it has enormous economic ramifications. Like you said, it's the second most valuable crop in the country. You know, it's something that already in Kentucky, if you look at the tobacco farmers who have been turning over to industrial hemp, all of that is going toward a non-psychoactive cannabinoid that is sold semi-legally, semi-illegally nationwide.
It's fascinating. I mean, for me as a person who has an understanding of agriculture and intellectual property more than the average person because of what I do, this might be the first time that many people are hearing about issues like utility patents.
Yeah, and people don't want to believe it. They don't understand how it's possible.
That's Amanda Chicago Lewis. She writes a column for Rolling Stone about cannabis. Find a link to her article on the Great Pot Monopoly Mystery on the Good Food website. As fires torched Sonoma, Napa, and Mendocino counties last fall, many worried about the impact on the wine industry. But the region's cannabis growers were also in the middle of peak harvest season. I'm talking with our friend Jeff, the 420 chef, about the fires and their impact on newly legal cannabis. I understand that the loss to cannabis farmers in the northern counties of California was significant.
Yeah, it was. There are over 30 farms up there. And although we don't know the dollar amount, it's definitely in the millions.
And we should remember that none of these folks can go to an insurance company. So
correct.
Those are total losses. It may be presumptuous to believe that because recreational cannabis is now legal, the demand will be higher, but we can assume. How do you think the loss of the crops will affect supply and price?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously supply and demand, right? Supply goes down, demand goes up, the price goes up. There are a lot of big farmers up there, and there was a lot of crop that was lost. Unfortunately, most of it, if it wasn't burned, was tainted not only with smoke residue from the forest fires, but also from toxins. So, you know, as the homes burned and all those toxic chemicals in those homes burned as well, the smoke that was up there was not only filled with, you know, your typical forest fire type smoke, but also from the toxins, as well as toxins from the FOSS check that they used to put the fires out.
It's interesting because we're just now starting to hear stories about how vintners are going through their pressed grape juice, which isn't quite wine yet, and seeing if there's any scorch damage, any smoke damage. What can a cannabis farmer do to sort of remediate their crop from these effects?
Well, we're not really sure. I have a cleaning process that I'm patenting right now that I've been using for years to remove the chlorophyll as well as surface contaminants from cannabis to make tasteless canna butter and canna oil. My thought is that if I'm taking out chlorophyll and I'm also taking off surface contaminants, my process might also be able to remove smoke residue and anything on the top of the plant. I don't know, though. My challenge is getting one grower, just one grower, to work with me to send me product that I can actually put through my process and test. Because if I can clean that product and bring it down to a level which is approved, you know, and it's actually been proven to be now safe where we can take those chemicals and remove them from the cannabis, we might be able to save farmers a lot of money.
So we're sitting here. Let's go back to sort of this idea of smoke and trying to get rid of flavors that we don't want to be there. We're sitting here in the studio. There is some cannabis here in front of us in a closed container. And then you have a couple of vials. One looks like an oil and one looks like just liquid.
Very dirty water.
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah, so you know, what I like to do is I like to, when I take people through my process, especially people that want me to cook for them, you know, typically the way people will make butter or oil is they'll take cannabis, they'll throw it into a crock pot with butter or oil and some water so it doesn't scorch, leave it overnight, and they get with this really danky oil or butter. Or another way they might do it is they might use a machine, like the magical butter machine, grind the cannabis into the butter or oil. And of course, again, you have a very dirty oil, then you then have to strain it, and it tastes very danky. So what I have here is a process that I show everybody, that where you start out with your cannabis that smells like cannabis. So if you want, you can smell this right now.
Oh, it does smell just like cannabis.
Exactly.
And how would you describe these terpenes?
These terpenes are pinene.
Pinene, for me, it always goes to a rosemary place.
Yeah. That's that'd be pinene, right? So then what we do is we put it through my process, and this is after 12 hours in the process.
And we should remember that the tetrahydrocannabinols, THC, is fat-soluble.
Correct. It's not water-soluble. It's fat-soluble. And it's also, it only evaporates when your heat goes above 350, 355 degrees. When you're boiling it in the blanching process, it's only 212. So you're not really hurting the trichomes. Trichomes are the little crystal-like entities on the cannabis plant.
It makes everybody really happy when they see those.
Smell that.
Oh, yuck.
What does it smell like?
Pee, kind of.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It smells actually like the can of oil or can of butter that you would buy that where they don't clean it, right? So this is all that dirt, all the contaminants plus chlorophyll that comes out of it. And you don't want to ingest that. Compare this to the original.
To the original resinous?
Yes.
It's so much more subtle. It's and more floral.
Yeah, because we took out pretty much everything that creates taste. If you were to, depending on the strain, sometimes it'll smell like nothing. So it really depends on the strain. This strain specifically was a very high terpene content, and it's got a very, very light smell. But when you infuse it into oil, and this is the oil that we infused with this strain, you tell me what the oil smells like.
And we should just...
And it's olive oil, just so you know.
And we should just say again that the reason we're talking about getting rid of all these aromatics is because you're the 420 chef, so we're interested in cooking with it.
Correct.
When you are going to ingest it in other modes, perhaps through smoking, a vape, whatever, you would want more flavor in
Correct.
That situation.
Correct, and you also want the terpenes, and you want that. Although some people don't like that either, and they'll do the free leaf and they'll smoke it, but...
Okay, first of all, you need a better quality of olive oil. I'm just telling you.
Okay.
I detect absolutely no marijuana
cannabis,
in this.
Yeah. And that actually
can I
happens
taste
to
it?
Be sure you can, absolutely. Yeah.
How bizarre.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. That's the Julia Child of Weed, Jeff the 420 chef. We've been talking about the Northern California fires and their impact on cannabis, as well as his process for cleaning it. In a moment, a visit to Venice Beach to ask people what they crave when they're high. Yep, we're talking munchies. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. This week, we've been looking at all things pot. If you like to get high, you might well be acquainted with the phenomenon of very specific food cravings. Last year, our producer Joseph Stone visited Venice Beach to find out what people reach for when they get the munchies.
When I'm high, what do I like to munch on? I love Butterfingers, bro. Butterfingers are the bomb.
One of my favorite desserts when I'm high would be the Twix ice cream bars.
Cereal, probably a mixture, so like half shreddies, half granola.
Any Mexican food, like El Pastor tacos, carne asada.
Chocolate, anything chocolate. Peanut butter and jelly with bacon. It was so bomb.
I ate cherry poppins. It's a dessert that was invented high. And it's like graham crackers with ice cream and toasted marshmallows and Marciano cherries with like the cherries on top. And depending on how high, we might put more chocolate.
I like soft pretzels. I eat soft pretzels on, you know, you can buy them anywhere. You can buy them at the grocery store, 7-Eleven, pop them in the microwave. So bomb.
See, it depends for me. It depends on my mood at the moment. But like I'll sometimes like Cracker Jacks. Or I'll go to like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or just mix whatever's in the fridge. So it really depends on my mood at the time.
You gotta work with what you got when you live by yourself. It's what it is.
I don't know. I can't think of anything right now.
Have you ever been to like a movie theater and you put like chocolate, like raisins or M&Ms in the popcorn? I like doing that at home. I think that's pretty good.
I like Flamin' Hot Cheetos. And you know what I like so much about the Flamin' Hot Cheetos? When you're all done, your fingers are red hot.
You have to have like a salty, sweet combination. I got really high the other day and I ate like a whole bag of potato chips and Oreos. And if I'm really sad, I'll get ice cream.
Candy blunt is, my girlfriend made it. It was Gusher, it was like a fruit roll up that's like a sheet of candy. Oh, and then she put Gushers in it and then sprinkled some candy powder and rolled it up.
Wow.
It was like a candy blunt, we ate it.
Ribs.
Tight.
Ribs. Smothered and barbecued, baby back styled ribs.
I made a grilled cheese and I put a pineapple ring on it and it was a pineapple and grilled cheese and it was really good.
I'm trying to think what I eat, honestly. Like, I like to get those 24 bags of like kids chips that you normally like a mom puts in like a lunch box. And like sometimes I've been known to knock back at least 20 of the 24 when I'm hot.
You know what? I prefer hot Cheetos, you know what I'm saying, with some nacho cheese on the side. It really don't matter. Like at the time when you high, you know what I'm saying, anything could really be used as dip. You know, it could be ranch. It could be a cheese. It could be the sour cream. Sour cream and Doritos, man. And a bowl of cereal is always adequate, you feel me? So,
we eat brownies. That's all I eat. Words.
You like to eat words? What kind of words?
Delicious words.
What's a delicious word?
Delicious.
Mushroom pizza.
The kind that get you high.
The kind that gets you high, yeah.
I like some munchies. You know, the spicy kind. UFO ice cream, a couple of those.
Gotta have a chai iced tea. A push pop off the bat. So you gotta have like the little gummy snacks. You need like, you need the big bag of chips, maybe some munchies like my man said, but I don't know about that, but.
Get stoned first, so.
Yeah. I make my own popcorn. I put real butter on it. I put some salt and some pepper, a little bit of garlic, Parmesan cheese. Oh my goodness. You can take down a whole bowl.
Uncle Junebug's mac and cheese. We saute grilled onions and garlic, like a lot. So it's dank. It's real dank, you know? And then you put the mac and cheese inside and you know, that's how we roll when we faded.
Back in the day, we would take the gummy bears when we were eating lunch, put them on the dash of the car so they would get all warm while we ate. And then as soon as we were done eating, we would take the gummy bears and throw them in the ice chest and let them freeze for a few minutes and then eat the gummy bears. It looked like a fruit roll-up pizza.
Does anything that is in the fridge?
Fried chicken, bro, that's the best.
I like fruit roll-ups.
I like ramen.
Pizza. With pepperoni.
Chocolate.
In-N-Out, double-double animal style.
Taco. Ice cream.
Ice cream.
I love Persian ice cream.
I like eating gummy bears.
Trader Joe's snacks are really good.
Spaghetti or pizza, pineapple pizza.
Fruity Pebbles.
Anything with Nutella is pretty good. Yeah.
French fries.
I like Rice Krispie treats and ice cream.
Everything, basically.
The Munchies montage comes to us from our producer, Joseph Stone. Now, a quick break from cannabis to hear from our friend Jonathan Gold. He's recently made some bold predictions in the LA Times about food trends Angelenos can expect to see this year. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
So I don't remember. It seems to me this is the first time you've actually made a prediction list.
I think I've done it before, but yeah, maybe not in the last couple of years.
So you actually did this top 10 prediction list. Let's hit as many of them as we can.
It's more trends that I see coming than like rubbing the crystal ball thing. But my number one this year, and it's silly to call it a trend or a prediction, but in Los Angeles, at least, women are going to have as important a voice in the kitchen as they deserve to have, and as I think they probably did back in the early 90s.
Do you think that this will also translate to attention from the media?
I think we've always tried to write about women chefs as much as we can, to include the voices in the dialogue. And, you know, at a certain point, women chefs were the dialogue in Los Angeles, you know, with people like you and Nancy Silverton and Suzanne Goyen and Dominique Crenn was here, Lydia Shire was here, Mary Sue and Susan, Suzanne Track, Odette Fada, Josie, definitely, Ciamara, definitely, you know, Get It a Gonifer, Monique King, who I think is a really important chef. There was a period where we almost didn't have to, like, talk about it, where we were snickering about the idea of, so what's it like to be a woman chef? And then a certain kind of technique-driven cuisine became the lingua franca. And for some reason, it started to be a boys' town for a long time. And I think that the idea of women-driven kitchens is definitely back in the mainstream.
I'm very happy to hear that. Next.
Fermentation.
Yeah, I just feel like fermentation has moved from a, like, DIY sort of outlier on the side to being, like, everybody has to do it.
You can't be a serious chef now without having some kind of fermentation going. I'm not even sure that it's true, but, I mean, you always heard whispers that Dave Varin, like, took a while to open dialogue because he was waiting for his fermentations to, like, take place. I think it's a great thing.
Now, where are we? We're number three now.
Which I call Israeli cooking, and I have some people snap at me and say, you mean Middle Eastern cooking.
But it isn't Middle Eastern cooking. It's something, it has a different sort of modern flavor, twist, or something.
The young chefs doing this are Jewish. Many of them have spent a lot of time in Israel. And there's this thing with Israel. It's a small country where a lot of cultures just slam together in interesting ways. In the same way that Singapore is probably smaller than some golf courses Trump owns. But you have so many cuisines coming together there in ways that they don't anywhere in the world. And it's not just hummus and shakshuka and grilled meats. It's the idea of extreme freshness. I mean, Israel, nothing is more than a two-hour drive away, right? The jolts of acidity everywhere, the vegan friendliness, the idea of smoke in almost everything, and the spices, all kinds of Middle Eastern spices.
And then that brings us to the next trend,
which is carpetbaggers.
I'm sure they love being called that.
Well, it's strange, right? I mean, it's like you had, or at least just in the last year, you had, like, you know, Dave Varin, Dominique Ancel, and April Blumfeld, like, opening places. And in the next couple of months, or have just opened, you have restaurants from Daniel Hume, David Chang, Christina Tosi, Jessica Largy, Chad Robertson, Elizabeth Pruitt, Chris Bianco, Daniel Patterson, and that's just the James Beard Award winners.
That's a pretty amazing list.
That's a lot. And, you know, Enrique Alvera, who owns Cosme in New York, and, of course, Pujol in Mexico City is opening up here, too.
Wow. Okay, so after carpetbaggers comes...
You know, Los Angeles and the Southern California area have been thought of for a bit as, like, one of the most exciting places to eat and open restaurants, you know, with our produce and the creativity and the, you know, extreme diversity. But there's been, like, one little space that was left, and that's restaurants way at the top. And I'm not sure if that was a lack, but it's certainly a market niche. And with, you know, Dialogue Vespertine and Wolfgang Puck's new Rogue Experience, among other places, I think that you're going to be able to drop $400 for a meal without buying sushi.
Yeah, all those guys from Mountain View need somewhere to fly down south, right?
Otherwise, their private jets are just going to remain unused.
Unused. We wouldn't want that. Okay, next.
Backyard gardens. It's like, again, with the hyper-local agriculture. I know we've been talking about it a lot, but it's almost become a thing for chefs to become attached to, you know, even really good backyard gardens. Is it a new thing here? Not necessarily. And you see restaurants of the world, like Noma just moved so that they could grow a lot of their stuff on premises. The restaurant that I like a lot called Attica in Melbourne, Ben Shuri is growing like a huge percentage of what he serves, like a block away from the restaurant. So I think it's a niche, but I think it's a really nice one. Seven is the continuing punch of Korean cooking.
Everything's Korean.
Everything's Korean now. And whatever vernacular cooking is in LA, it has at least a little bit of traditional tastes and techniques from, like, you know, kimchi to hot pepper paste, gochujang to soy sauce marinades to, you know, reconstituted dried roots and greens. You're finding a lot of Korean stuff in completely un-Korean restaurants now. And that's a nice thing.
It is a nice thing, a very nice thing.
Number eight is better tortillas.
I just hope that prediction comes true. And it isn't just super effete, elitist, just unusual outlier places that have better tortillas.
Well, I think a lot because of the work of guys who've been on the show a lot, like Carlos Salgado, bringing the corn up, you can find really nice tortillas at the best sort of new style Mexican restaurants made from old breed corn. And you're even finding places like Sonora Town or Salazar making flour tortillas with locally grown wheat.
Really good. Number nine?
Asian desserts. Every time you look at an Instagram feed now, it's like charcoal black soft serve or chewy Thai style ice milk or like tricks soaked in liquid nitrogen or boxes of steamed cheesecake, cereal milk lattes, cheese tea. Have you seen cheese tea?
That's a road too far.
And those Hong Kong egg waffles that look like wall paneling from the 70s. I'm not sure what this year's big one's going to be, but it's probably going to have popped up last year in either Tokyo or Taiwan. And by the time that you get around to trying it, it will already be over.
The 18-year-olds will lead us to the trough of that one. And then number 10?
Is fire. And fire's been around here a while. I mean, the smell of smoke is what characterized local cooking from the time of Wolfgang Puck, who was the first guy in the mainstream to put a grill at the middle of his hotline. But it seems like two-thirds of the restaurants opening now involve wood, including, you know, the Neapolitan pizza stuff, the medieval fire pits at Gwen. Have you seen those? To the, you know, the Inferno at the heart of Hearth and Hound, and even the Chinese places in the San Gabriel Valley that serve cumin-crusted lamb skewers. And there are dozens of them now, and they're all open super late at night. And it seems like they almost might be pushing out Hot Pot, which has been going on for so long.
That's Jonathan Gold giving us his top 10 predictions for LA food trends in 2018. He, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866, and you will have a marvelous archive of Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. In a minute, we're back to talking about weed, this time with a small grower who's speaking out about the challenges she faces. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we've been talking about California's new cannabis rules.
Most cannabis farmers are great at farming and trimming and curing their cannabis, but they're not really the best at, you know, marketing themselves or coming up with genius packaging or, you know, working through all the policy.
That's Chia Rodriguez, a small pot farmer in Mendocino County. In the wake of legalized weed, a whole new set of issues is compounding the already long list of challenges facing many small growers. Chia says she's adopting a learn-as-you-go mentality, like many of her peers.
Well, here in California, we have about 7 different agencies, I believe, that we have to work with to get through the licensing and the permitting process. And those include the state water boards, Department of Fish and Wildlife, the BCC, which is the Bureau of Cannabis Control, the CDFA, which is the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and the CDTFA, which is what formerly was the SBOE and the Tax and Fee Administration now. And there's lots of little local things that we have to do to accomplish this, like insurance, and there's a lot of different agencies, a lot of paperwork. Now farmers are just doing a lot of paperwork in the off season.
Because previously you were just growing and it was sort of like a renegade activity. So you weren't plugged into the more traditional farming world, which has dealt with a lot of these agencies for a long time.
Correct. We were, just doing our thing and we're kind of haphazardly tripping through farming and life without dealing with those regular agencies that, you know, normal businesses work with.
It must be really daunting and kind of frightening, actually.
Daunting for sure. I feel it's really encouraging and actually kind of exciting because this is something that I personally have been waiting for forever. And I know a lot of other farmers, especially in my area, Mendocino County, California, have been waiting for. This is something that we've been hoping for and working really hard to accomplish, and it's finally here. So most people are embracing it.
What are some of the hoops and the requirements that you need to cross off your list so that you can be granted a license?
I have been working towards this for quite a few years, actually. And I started early. I'm one of those, I love to plan ahead. So whenever something came up, I was right on it. Was one of the first people to get enrolled with the water board. I was the 12th applicant in Mendocino County to receive a permit. So personally, I've kind of just been forging ahead. And so the last little thing on my list is dealing with the Fish and Wildlife Department. There's a form called the LSA, which stands for the Lake and Stream Bed Alteration. This is something that any cannabis cultivator needs to fill out, whether they need one or not. They still have to fill out the form and apply with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And obviously that is backing up the Department of Fish and Wildlife's system. They're hiring new people all the time and trying to keep up with the demand here. And so I'm just in a kind of a limbo period waiting for that approval. The other side of things, just in terms of small paperwork that needs to happen, I need to get a surety bond that covers any potential problems with testing and the failure of any cannabis testing that happens. So that kind of covers the testing lab's cost, I guess. And that doesn't take much. It just takes a $350 fee, I think, annually on average, depending on your credit rating. So that's something that I've been waiting to do and just waiting on my insurance agent at this point.
And then once you get your cultivation license, initially it's going to be temporary, right? Just valid for 120 days. What happens after that 120 days pass?
Okay, well, some of us were able to apply for our temporary state license back in December. I applied on the first day it was available, and I just got my final approval. It goes through a 3-step approval process. I got that yesterday.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It took a few weeks. And so once you get that, the 120 days apparently started on January 1st. I thought it was from the application date, and I still might be wrong, but so we have 120 days basically to then apply for our annual license. And in that time, you need to accomplish all of those list of requirements. If, for instance, that LSA from the Department of Fish and Wildlife doesn't come through or get approved by then, then the state can give you a 90-day extension. And there's two 90-day extensions available for you, but that's not something that you can apply for personally. The state grants those to cultivators. It's kind of up to them, depending on where things are at with those other departments and all the paperwork that you have.
In addition to this state license, do you need some kind of permission or license in your local area?
Exactly. So it actually started originally in the county. So we had to apply for our local permit. And once the county approved your permit, you were granted your final official permit. And then you could apply for that temporary license. But what they were discovering is that here in Mendocino County, as of only a couple weeks ago, we only had around 61 approved permits in total out of around 800 applicants. And that number is growing every day. And so the county discovered that obviously that wasn't going to serve a very large portion of the cultivation population. So they decided that you could then apply at the state level for your temporary license with simply just your application receipt to the county. So you were able to turn in an original application, which you paid the fee for. They gave you a stamped, notarized piece of paper that said that you have officially applied. And now they're accepting that as part of the application process for the temporary state license. So that helped out, obviously, a lot more people. And hopefully most of those 800 people in Mendocino County have applied for their temporary license.
Mendocino is known as an area with a lot of small growers, correct?
Correct. We've been, notoriously a cannabis cultivating county for, back 40 years or even more, probably. Our local jurisdiction decided that we would stick with the maximum amount of square footage per farmer at 10,000 square feet. If you wanted to be a nursery to cultivate genetics to sell, you could also apply for that, totaling 22,000 square feet.
Does this impact quite a few people to have to downsize their operations, or is it about right as a fit for the county?
That's an interesting question. I imagine there were some people that were growing over 10,000 square feet before that were bummed out about that ordinance being put in place. But for the most part, I think that due in part to the water issues here, we're not really a county known for tons and tons of water, that people were sticking to smaller cultivation areas for that reason. And also probably smaller cultivation areas due to the fact that there was quite a lot of enforcement happening and people didn't really want to plant rurally on the side of a hill with a large space. And that's kind of like putting a target on your back. So I think most people were keeping things pretty simple. And we have neighbors in Humboldt County, on the other hand, who are allowed to have 1 acre per parcel of cultivation, and they can stack those next to each other if you have contiguous parcels up to 3, I believe. So you could have 3 solid acres of cultivation. And so that's quite a big difference.
So now that you're having to add expenses you never faced before in terms of licensing and all the different agencies you have to deal with, you are held back to a certain level of production. I would imagine you're also going to have logistical issues that you're going to have to deal with that you never had to before, like waste and pest management.
Mm-hmm.
How is it going to work for a lot of Mendocino farmers that are on the small side from a business standpoint? Do you feel like you're being pushed out?
Yeah, that's definitely a realistic threat. Right now, one advantage that we have is I started a group called Mendocino Generations. And Mendocino Generations was founded by my husband and myself and a couple of neighbors a couple years ago. And I currently am the operations director of that group. We have about 35 farmers with a substantial waiting list, and we're doubling our membership this year. So in 2018, we're hoping to have around 70 farms. And our goal is to help small farmers survive. And we decided that banding together and uniting with that greater purpose, it was going to help us actually be able to deal with this tsunami wave of the amount of cannabis in the market and all these fees and all the legislation and the paperwork and just the mounting heap of the to-do list. And so that so far has been working very well. We have many farmers that have various skills and interests that we can combine together to kind of create a stronger alliance. Those things, you know, from policy analysis, we have a team that helps navigate that. So they would digest all the policy information that comes down, whether it's from the testing side of things or local legislation or to state legislation. And then they would kind of give the rest of the farmer group the download. So the farmers don't individually have to spend all their time trying to research and learn as they go. And we're also focusing a lot on marketing and distribution, helping the farmers get out to market. And so as a group of small farmers banded together, I think we can accomplish that really well. And I have started seeing more and more groups being formed around, not just in our county, but across the state, similar to what we're doing for that very reason.
Do you see yourself as supplying cannabis to dispensaries throughout the state, or are you trying to keep it pretty local?
No, in order to have competition in the market and really get our brand out there, we have to have things in all far reaches of California. We work with some distribution companies that have many relationships down south in LA area and Southern California.
In your area, are you seeing outsiders like venture capitalists coming in?
Definitely. I think that a lot of people who are looking to capitalize on the industry in other ways are really looking at investing in the industry. And there's so many people on so many sides of things trying to figure out how they can fit into the industry. And there's been a lot of creativity around that, really seeing tons of new businesses and from event production to the film industry to distribution and branding and all kinds of things.
Does the money flowing in feel like an opportunity for you or a threat?
I feel like at this point, it's bringing more opportunity. You know, my only caution is that we bring in good investors that are really, you know, looking out for those small farmers and these small businesses or startup businesses. Because as you know, that's a risky thing to take on a large investor that's, you know, maybe doesn't really understand the industry completely or have a relationship with you. And so we're currently in the middle of working towards finding investment for our own group, but helping other farmers do the same. And it's not to be taken lightly.
Well, good luck.
Thank you. Me too.
That's Chia Rodriguez on the hurdles small pot farmers face. Find a link to her Washington Post op-ed on the Good Food website. That is it for this week's show about California's new era of pot. For more on what's happening with legalized weed, KCRW has put together a fantastic resource for you. Visit kcrw.com/legalized. Before we go, I want to mention the passing of a culinary giant. Legendary French chef Paul Bocuse died last week at the age of 91. He was regarded as perhaps the most influential chef of the 20th century. In the coming weeks, tune into Good Food to hear more about Chef Bocuse's legacy. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, or you can find us on Apple Podcasts. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.